This is GeekSpeak for Saturday, November 28th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks' affiliated organizations. Hello, I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist, iOS developer, and a lifelong tinkerer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing, Lyle?
Quite well, thank you. And Mr. Ben Jaffe, the unemployed. Hello, welcome to GeekSpeak.
What a title.
Well, you are technically unemployed,
it's true.
So it's a good title.
Technically unemployed. I'm in that awkward gap between jobs, and I'm actually, so I will no longer be working at Udacity as a course developer and programmer, and I will soon be working at Facebook starting on January 4th.
What's
Facebook? Facebook? Yeah. you haven't heard of it.
No, what is it?
You should listen to GeekSpeak.
Is it the social media giant?
So we talk about
Facebook
a lot.
Most of the planet.
We talk about Facebook a lot on GeekSpeak. Yeah. After January 4th, whenever it comes up, I'm just going to shut up.
It's like when I started Netflix. Anytime we talked about media and like all that stuff, I had to kind
of
quiet
sudden,
down.
Yeah.
Mysteriously.
You know, Brian's going to get like a Google or an Apple job, and we won't be able to talk about anything on the show.
I know. It's true. Or no, we'll just trade off.
Yeah, exactly. So what are you going to be doing for Facebook?
I am going to be a front-end engineer. But
when you say going to be, when do you start?
On January 4th.
Whoa, that's a long duration of not
yes.
working.
So like I said, I'm in that awkward gap. And usually that gap can be a week or 2 weeks. For me, it's 6.5 weeks or something like that.
So wait a second. What is so awkward about 6 weeks of bliss?
Especially when you're about to make the monies.
Well, it's strange because when you have a job, 8 hours of your day are accounted for. You don't have to decide what to do during those hours, right? You're working on a project, you're collaborating with people, unless you're a project manager, in which case you're kind of following the company's direction.
Yeah.
But when you're unemployed, when you're in that in-between space, you have to figure out, what do I do with 8 more hours in my day? Like, that's crazy. I sleep for 8 hours. I spend 8 hours, I don't know, watching.
So the GeekSpeak website could use some work.
right,
I have
yeah.
a room to paint. You could come paint my house.
Wait a second. I've always had this observation, especially when I see people who are getting to retirement age. And I've known a lot of the parents I grew up with. They reached a retirement age, and there was this dread for them. Like, what are they going to do now?
Yeah.
How are they going to fill their time? And I always thought to myself, there's definitely two people in the world, and I'm the other kind of person. If I had nothing to do, if I was independently wealthy, I can't imagine even having a moment of time. There'd be so many projects I'd want to do.
Yeah, definitely.
There's actually a wonderful episode that I just listened to about retirement from Freakonomics.
Ah, great show.
Yeah, it was talking about how, if you retire and you aren't doing things, then it kills. That sounds so epic. And
so you are, I'm assuming, overblown. Doing things while you're this free time.
I have a lot of things to do. I mean, usually I do too many things.
Yeah.
I play music. I build things.
You have a couple podcasts.
Garden. Yeah, I have more than one podcast. Sorry, guys.
Hey, is Linear Digressions going to continue if you're leaving Udacity? Oh, good.
Yes.
Oh, that's great.
It will continue on.
So you guys will it still be affiliated with your former employment, or will it be independent?
What's no, we're just kind of rolling it off.
Oh, that's great. So Linear Digressions is a great podcast, everybody.
Yeah, LinearDigressions.com. It's a show about data science and machine learning. We'll probably be, hopefully, if I can convince Katie to do more work on it over the next 6 weeks, we'll be churning out more episodes.
That would make sense. It's a good thing to do during this time.
Yeah, but at
and
the same time.
And if you want more sultry tones of Mr. Ben Jaffe, that's a great podcast to listen to.
At the same time, this is the problem, is that most of the people I know are employed.
Right.
So I've got 8 hours that not only is it 8 hours that I have to spend finding things to do with myself, right?
Yeah.
But I can't call up my friends and say, hey, do you want to get coffee?
Right.
Hey, do you want to see a movie? Because my friends are all at work.
We do
so,
that.
So, yeah. It's,
hey, Brian,
it's strange.
Before this job you currently have, what was the gap between jobs for you?
That's not a fair question.
No, I know.
That was 9 years.
9 years. But to be fair, during that time, you were raising children.
And building an apartment and building a new career and, yeah. and many other
you're
things.
You were busy.
Yeah.
But currently, you're looking, you're doing iOS development as well, yes?
Yes.
And so you're a very busy person. Kids, job, and extra iOS development.
Yes, yes, yeah. Exactly.
So Ben could help you out, right?
Yeah, you want to learn yeah. iOS? Actually, no, you want to do my day job? That would be even better.
Ben, you mentioned earlier before the show that one of the things you want to talk about is kind of that odd space. I'm glad we talked about it. But I realized that the last three jobs I've transitioned, I actually did the opposite direction. I did both jobs at the same time to give.
Oh, no.
So when I left the university, I worked for 3 months while I worked for the company 4D. And when I left 4D, I actually worked for them again after I worked for Netflix.
You didn't
so
take
I never,
time off.
I have not had time off between jobs for, I don't know,
why,
15 years.
Why would you do that to yourself?
Insane. Now, the Geek Speak's been going on that entire time too. So yeah. Another job.
Wait a second. True. You went to Paris in that time. Yes, you were working, but
I was working hard. You know how hard it is to fly to Paris and talk on stage? Man. By
my
the way, if you're looking
tired.
For anybody, why aren't you about to fly to Paris and talk on stage?
Yeah, I'll do that in April.
Woohoo. Let's get on with the show, shall we? Shall we?
Yeah.
We've had let's talk about some Apple and tweet and such. Brian, this is yours.
Okay, so last week you gave a review of the Apple TV.
Yeah, I hope it didn't sound like a sales pitch. I do like the thing, but I realized afterwards that maybe I was too like, yay.
You didn't have us with you to
right.
keep you honest.
I did it by myself.
I saw this tweet from somebody I follow. His name's Guy English.
Sure.
And just think about this for a moment. So, you know, the like you covered last week, the remote for the Apple TV has a Siri button. You hold it up and you speak to it.
Sure.
So the quote he put up there was, when I jump onto the computers app on my Apple TV, I hold the button, hold it close to my face and say, computers? Of course, that's an allusion to Scotty back from...
Yes.
From
computer?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Hello, computer. Just use the keyboard.
I wish I could do that accent.
Star Trek
that
4.
That would have been
funnier. Nice, Ben. Good
there
Star Trek.
Factory.
Are you excited about the new... Yeah, we already talked about that.
Yeah.
But think about that. Our computers are now just accepting our commands, just like
they really
20
are.
Years ago in that movie.
I want to reprogram my phone, so instead of saying, okay, Google, blah, 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 I have to say, in the accent, computer... And then it'll accept
that
my
sounds,
voice commands.
That sounds a good idea.
Or nuclear vessels.
Nuclear whistles.
Vessels.
We also get some feedback from listeners who participate on Facebook or email us at geekspeak.org to give us extra stuff. We got something from Bruce this week.
So 2 weeks ago, we mentioned Amazon reviews in our discussion and how much information you can get from them. And Bruce wrote in to make a really good point that I think we should all just recognize for a moment, which is if you see a review on Amazon or really any site that offers reviews, and it's got a lot of 5 stars to that item, you've got to definitely... look into those reviews to see mm-hmm. if they have any value. You can click
like
on
substance to them.
It's substance to them. You can click on the name of the reviewer and usually see the other items they reviewed.
That's
and
right.
If they are unrelated or there's many of them that are unrelated, that 5-star review should be tossed out and ignored.
And the reason for that is that companies that are selling products will hire people to rate stuff with high ratings. To
that
falsify
sense.
And push the data. Right, of course it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I don't particularly like star ratings. I like written reviews of a personal experience and on a device, you know, something that takes some time, like I recently investigated table saws. And in that, you know, hearing people's discussion about them was much more interesting than whether they rated a 4 or 5, right? I'd rather like hear all that detail.
And you've got to have your radar on good to look for the information you're looking for.
Right.
You can't just say, oh, this was great, and accept that review.
And I think the reason I brought up Amazon before in reviews is that even if you're not using Amazon as your purchasing vehicle, you can access the reviews. They're free to access. And that's a really great resource, even if you don't like buying stuff from them.
The problem with written reviews is they take time to go through, right? So if, like, I was looking for a phone case, for example, and there were, I don't know, 18,000 cases I could possibly buy.
But you've got time on your hands, so.
Right. I was buying this in the middle of last week when I didn't have time on my hands.
Yes.
And, I don't want to wade through a bunch of, I don't know, it's a level above YouTube comments sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes
it's
it is.
Not great.
I don't read reviews on, like, phone cases, right? Because what are they, $20 or less? and you can always return them, and normally they're okay. So I'll look at like the 5 stars and go, oh, that one's probably good, buy it. And
then well, it's really bad. It's proportional to how much money you're spending and how much you
That's right.
So like a table saw, you probably want the best table saw you can
find. And I got a really great one. So if you want to know about that, you can email me. I'm Lyle@geekspeak.org, and I'll tell you all about it because I don't want it to be an ad if you're looking for table saw.
So this is a good opportunity. Not only do I want to thank Bruce for writing in, but we've had a whole host of listeners writing in lately with stories and comments, and
we love it.
Yeah, we absolutely do. In fact, 2 weeks ago, many of those stories came from listeners that wrote in, and I just want to say a big thank you. It's fantastic to get some feedback, and even though we can't respond to every single email, we all have our busy lives, except for Ben.
And we do read them all. I read them all.
We do read them all, and we try to get back to the important ones that as much as we can.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
and you can contact us all over the place, and I'll give that information in a bit. So, Ben.
Yes.
What have you been thinking about?
Oh, yeah. I've had time to think.
Yeah.
No, I actually have been thinking about this for quite a while. So as a programmer, there's this concept that we all deal with of state, right? So if you take, say, let's say you're making a game and this car thing is driving around, the state of that car might have an X position, might have a Y position, it might have a speed, it might have an amount of damage, right? It's the properties that are changeable, that are mutable about this thing, right?
Okay.
So I like to think about humans as being very similar, right?
Geek.
So I've got my own internal state, right? Right now I'm feeling a teeny, teeny bit of anxiety, generally comfortable, relatively well-fed, a little bit tired.
Do you think this way so that if you were to model yourself in a computer simulation, you'd know the attributes? I mean, what does it do for you?
Have I not told you that I'm a cyborg?
why do you think this way about yourself? Not like I'm feeling well, but if I had to calculate myself and put myself in a game.
It's not so much that. Like, I don't get any utility from thinking about myself that way with such a simple example. But I have been thinking about how there are things in this world, a lot of times external things in this world, that change my internal state without me knowing. So for example, let's say I eat something that doesn't agree very well with me, right? That's something that came from the outside. It's not something that I'm necessarily in control of because I don't know that it's, you know, poisoned or something like that. And I eat it and I start feeling really bad and that affects me in these other ways. And then I get grumpy and then I get sleepy or whatever it is.
Eat is a public method. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Go on.
Yeah, eat is a public method. It can take anything.
Almost head,
anything.
I guess. Head,
yeah. Well, yeah. Anyway, that's an old joke,
by the way, about eating your own head. You can't actually do that. That's the one thing you can't do is eat your own head.
Yeah, I guess.
Have you ever seen a Plimpton cartoon?
Not a cartoon. Go on.
So I guess I've been thinking about like what things affect my internal state without me knowing. You know, like we've all had that moment when you're sitting next to somebody you love, you don't have any problems with them. And then, you know, they say something and you snap back at them and you're like, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And then you try and trace it back. Okay, well,
normally it's about things I haven't eaten, actually.
Right, exactly.
I really get sensitive about food.
Yeah. So there's one of them.
A little nasty.
I haven't eaten and so I get hangry. There's even a special
hangry,
word for it.
Word.
Hungry, angry, hangry. There's also if I haven't slept, I don't get angry. I just get a little bit grumpy and a little less responsive, right?
Mm.
But the one that I've been thinking a lot about because it's wintertime and I'm skinny is being cold. So when I get cold, I tend to get anxious and I tend to get a little bit irritable and I just feel a little bit off.
It's actually been fun watching you this evening because when you showed up, it took me 5 minutes or so to get you into the building. And so you were sitting outside cold. And so you came in and you, the first thing you said was, I'm not feeling great. I'm feeling a little anxious. And then we talked about temperature and all this stuff. So now you've warmed up. It's been a while.
Lyle, come let me into the
building.
Save
me. So,
And now I'm sitting here on the radio feeling slightly anxious because here I am talking about my feelings instead of, you know, some story that I found on Slashdot. And so I'm a little bit more sweaty. And so I took off my jacket, but that makes me more cold. So it's just like this whole like melding pot of physiological and psychological processes that affect my state, and ultimately all can be traced back to something that's external to me.
I love how geeky you're getting about emotional state and self-awareness, mm-hmm. right? That you translated into computer terminology is wonderful to me.
Right. But because we're both programmers, it makes
a lot of
sense.
I understand it in this way, but the ways I've heard of this kind of discussion has not been around technical understanding. I mean, it hasn't been around codifying it. So I like that you're using that terminology. I think that fits GeekSpeak quite well. But I'm curious, do you think you've changed over time? I mean, you just also had another milestone in your life. You just turned 30.
Oh, yeah.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. Thank you.
And so are you seeing this change over time, your awareness of it, or how much external factors affect you? Or both?
Oh, that's a hard one. I mean, it's hard to... I don't have the best memory, and so it's perhaps harder for me to introspect over time, to compare myself now to myself, say, a year ago or 5 years ago. I'm sure there are plenty of changes. Regarding the 30, turning 30, I actually don't really care. I really don't think I care. The only weirdness I feel about it is societally imposed, where people keep asking me, does it feel weird that you're 30? And I'm right. Like, it feels weird that people keep asking me about it. Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting, the different kinds of things that affect us and the things that don't.
So,
Brian?
So what I think is funny about this is programming. What it is about defining how your model fits together and defining all these concepts and abstracting them out. And psychology, the problems that we face every day, the last person that can see their problems is themselves.
Right.
Everybody
right.
can see their friend's problems so much better than their friend can themselves. But you're taking something that is this psychological thing and turning it into a computer model in your brain of looking at yourself, and so you can see your problems.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's very, very imperfect, of course. But it's a way of thinking about it, I guess, that makes it a little bit less about me, if that makes sense.
Sure.
You know, like it's not...
You can objectify what you're feeling a little bit,
yeah,
so you can
exactly.
consciously
Yeah, it's a,
of it.
It's a good sort of objectification.
This thing you're doing is actually generally called mindfulness, right? So...
Yeah, it's computer science mindfulness.
Yeah. Brian, do you practice mindfulness? Are you trying to always be aware of what's going on for you?
I practice grumpiness. Is that
food
is that,
or what's your trigger points?
What are your external things?
These days, my biggest trigger is if I don't get to do the projects that I'm so excited about.
What projects? Oh, really? Ice skating?
Ice skating. Actually, that is open now. No. Like the app projects. I'm working on the programming. Right now, that's the biggest thing in my life outside of work and kids and wife. It probably encroaches on all of those things.
My former job was working with students all the time at UCSC, and I was always engaged with technical discussions, but with people about their art projects. And so it was really kind of enriching and personal thing. And then I switched to doing like stage work, where I was doing a lot of presentations. And then I came to Netflix. And at Netflix, I am programming, unless I have a lot of meetings, I am programming all day. And at the end of that day, I am in a very different state than the days that I spent with students.
Right. How would you describe that state?
Well, not very functional. It's almost like I've lost my ability to have the social social skills. I really do kind of turn in this place where it's very analytical. Sometimes I'm thinking about my problem set at work, which of course still requires me to program set. But even if I'm listening to news and stuff, I'm in this weird space of dissecting it from like problem solving capability.
Right.
But I don't have a lot of empathy, I don't think, when I've done programming.
Because you have to be in your own head and it's, you don't use your empathy skills when programming.
Not much.
You use your analysis skills when programming. When communicating, you might use your empathy skills, but...
Yeah, I hope so.
Right. The ideal day for a programmer typically is described as, I didn't have any meetings. I didn't have to talk to anybody. I just sit down and like get in the zone, right?
So for the non-geeks out there thinking about this and running into a stereotype, programmer who's rude and grumpy and snaps at them and points out their terrible faults so quickly. Now you understand.
Keep in mind, when geeks point out your terrible faults, they're trying to compliment you. They respect you enough to help you because they figure, I want to know about my faults, so you probably want to know about your faults. And sometimes it comes across as not so polite.
Yeah. Just to close up this topic, I have found self-introspection to be both a fascinating use of my time, very, very useful. I learn a lot about myself and how to be more empathetic and how to be more present and more kind with people around me. So I would just like to invite anyone who's listening to the show, if you can hear my voice, you know, whenever you're driving next, take a moment to just think about that.
But focus on the road as well.
Oh, yeah.
This is GeekSpeak. We'll be right back. You're listening to GeekSpeak on independent public radio KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room is Brian Young and Mr. Ben Jaffe. We've been talking about being aware, and Ben's definitely recommending that you pay attention to how you're feeling. You want to say that again? Because I think I cut you off.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about like what's messing with your stuff, basically, right?
Good.
What's messing with you without you necessarily being aware of it?
And if you want to tell us how you deal with that and cope with that, please feel free to email us, especially if you can put a geeky slant on it. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. And of course, we're also available online at Facebook and all of those things. Brian, what is this beautiful device in front of you?
Doesn't that thing look giant?
It is massive.
What is that?
I've been wanting to strap some Velcro to the back so I can hold it up to my head and pretend it's the latest craze in the phones. But
in fact, it's the iPad Pro.
Yes, it's an iPad Pro, a nearly 13-inch tablet. Which I believe is the biggest one on the market now.
It might be. I have one too.
You have one too. It's, like, it's right next to me. I didn't even notice it.
It's really ridiculous. It's, the plethora of tech.
That's a huge screen.
It's massive.
If you haven't seen one of these in person, it is truly a surprise in size. You can't just get it from the pictures of other people.
So if you currently have an iPad, if you've been played with an iPad, a full size iPad, if you take two of them next to each other, that's the size of this thing. It's really big. Do you have a pencil?
I do not. I have not yet managed to scrape one out of the stores. I have one on order.
I used a colleague's pencil all day today.
Did you say, do you have a pencil? I'm sorry, I was distracted, yes. But what? What?
We didn't change subjects. Apple is calling their stylus a pencil.
Wait.
Even though it's a lot like a pen.
Wait, Apple has a stylus?
For the iPad Pro, they've got a stylus. Yeah.
Steve Jobs is probably rolling in his grave.
I know
right
it, right?
Like, that's great.
Hey, the Newton had a stylus.
So Apple has a stylus for this humongo thing. Why? For drawing?
Okay, so this thing actually...
This is slightly bigger than an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
In fact, look at it next to your screen. It's a massive iPad. And it's not that heavy. It's pretty thin. It feels a lot like the iPad Air, but it's a lot bigger. And the reason why Brian bought it is...
Okay, so among other things, I'm an artist. And I've dreamed of an iPad that could do this. In fact... my wife bought a Windows tablet, generation 2004, 2005, which included a Wacom stylus and pressure sensitivity.
Wacom has been the factor leader, this Kleenex, if you will, of styluses and tablet of touch surfaces.
Yes,
more
and they do multiple sensitivity pressures, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. So ever since the iPad came out, I was like, oh my goodness, this would be the absolute perfect device if they would just only add a stylus to the iPad.
A stylus, of course, is a handheld pen pointing device, right? That acts like a pen or a pencil.
Right. So for a layman, it's just, it seems like it's attempting to recreate just
paper.
Paper. Yeah. Buy a $900 device and a $100 stylus just to replicate paper.
That's ridiculous.
But no, here's the thing. I've been a digital artist since back in school. In 1993, I was using a Wacom tablet and a 13-inch CRT monitor trying to do the painting. Of course, I'm not drawing on the screen. I'm drawing on a tablet that's on the
desk.
With
a delay.
Yeah, well, the delay didn't matter that much as the blind drawing. You can't see.
Yeah, so the tablet is just this gray thing, and you draw on it, and you look up. Just kind of like you move a mouse on the desk, and it moves the cursor up above.
You can get really good at this.
Right, and I know some people were really good at it, but it's... still a little weird.
So yes, for years, you and I have been passing back and forth ideas on like what the best solution is. And of course, Wacom has a screen that's also a touch surface that plugs into your computer.
That's really expensive, right?
They are really expensive as well. And they work really well.
Well, they've got a generation that didn't have touch, and they have a generation that now has touch. But both of them take the Wacom stylus, which is pressure sensitive. It also is sensitive to the angle, the tilt of the pen.
And rotation.
And these are... Oh, it does rotation.
I think some of them have rotation.
These are like all of the attributes that you would utilize with an actual paintbrush.
Right.
Like the angle would change the way the brush works. The rotation might if the brush was a special shape.
I mean, a real paintbrush or any kind of medium, because these are all try to copy mediums, have so much different types of rule sets around them that modeling them realistically is not something we can do.
Right.
But we can trick our mind
into
doing it. Like charcoal, right? Charcoal, every time you use charcoal on paper, it's changing its shape. right? The entire time it's slowly changing shape because it's wearing away. And so you don't have one shape. You modify the shape over time. And then, of course, you can turn it and get different shapes out of it instantaneously. And you get broad strokes by turning it outside. So it's not like the styluses, even the really good one that we'll talk about in a second for the pro, replaces these mediums. But it sure is easy to have like 20 different mediums that do a pretty good job without having dirty hands and ink on the floor.
Paint. So if you're looking to replace something that's in the real physical world, this will never do it. Just get that out of your mind. What this is about being a digitally native painter.
Yeah.
And it is an awesome experience when you can just build up layers and do your painting and work in this way where you have more control than you possibly ever could have with paint and paper.
That's interesting. So it's like, you don't have as much control with the thing that you're actually painting with, but you have tremendously more control because you can work with transparency, you can create different layers and manipulate them after the fact. Whereas with paint, once you put a brush stroke on your painting, you can't move that brush stroke.
There's different painting techniques, but traditionally with like watercolor, that's absolutely true. There's almost nothing forgiving about watercolor. You put it down there and you're not going to get it off.
That's it, yeah.
Of course, other techniques and other mediums have their own advantages and disadvantages, but with digital painting, you've got all these techniques that allow you to play and experiment without the, well, as long as you're smart about it, as long as you have a little bit of forethought, without the fear of messing anything up.
My friend here at Netflix actually has a pencil. He got one before he got his Pro. And so today I borrowed
Apple
it and
pencil.
Had it all day. Yeah, sorry. A stylus for the Apple Mac Pro thing. And so I was able to use it all day. And at one point I took a 20-minute break from my busy programming day and actually just drew. And I've been using the app, the software that I use on this app called Procreate. I use it on the iPhone and the iPad traditional. And it's a good app. With the stylus that actually has pressure sensitivity and tilt, it was really cool. I have to say, though, all of these apps suffer from this major thing, and that is that my mother gave me charcoal and crayon and paint when I was very young, and my ability to move those things haven't changed very much, and paper hasn't changed very much in the 40 years I've been painting and drawing, and so those things are a lot easier to use than the software that you have to still kind of figure out. I think if I actually... That's the thing I'm excited about this device the most, is that I'll actually have a device that's easy on, always available, works all the time. I don't have to set up a secondary machine or be, it's allows me to practice like I do with paper and pen.
Right.
And that's what's exciting about it. Yeah.
It brings it into that space where you can just play with it, not a table tucked away in the corner of your house or your office.
Yeah.
Now, as much as I'm glowing about the iPad, the iPad Pro and the stylus, I haven't actually gotten to use it more than just a little bit. I have a lot of experience with the Wacom versions and things like that. But what I wanted to talk about today was what this enormous screen is like to use for the other parts of the iPad that are not involving the stylus.
Is this yay or nay? You like it or not?
Well, here's the thing. I'm so excited about this. And it has a use to me even without the rest of the operating system being ready.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not.
Ben, did you catch that? The rest of the operating system is not ready.
The pen is fantastic. And when I get mine...
It's almost $1,000 and it's not really ready yet.
No. This is completely an early adopter toy.
Man, the interface is pretty bad. I mean, they blew the size of this thing up, but the actual amount of icons on the screen is the same. It's ridiculous. It looks comical.
Oh my gosh. I see what you mean.
Yeah. Well, right? Doesn't that look kind of like a child's toy that's been blown up?
More than that, we have, 7-8 years of iPhone and iPad apps that are now created. And I've got 5 or 6 or 7 that I use every day that have not been updated for this.
Yeah.
Their text is enormous when I open them up. It's like I could read it from across the room. I'm not using all this wonderful space. And it has a great feature called split screen, which allows you to have 2 apps on screen at once. Yes, the Windows world, and everybody's been mocking the iPad.
And Android's done this for a long time,
too. And Android for not having multitasking. Well, we have it now. The problem is so many of the apps that I use aren't updated to use it, so it's of no use.
Well, Brian, your timer app that we use to control the show recording times works perfectly. So there you go.
Yeah, I've kept that one up to date.
And I got to say, the first thing I did, of course, is installed the Netflix app, because that's the app I work on, and downloaded it from the store and booted it up, and I immediately had a motion billboard, which is the large screen video that plays automatically to kind of promote our own shows. And it was very rewarding to have that work. And the sound system is really good in this thing. It's got a good sound system, which I like for, you know, television viewing type of stuff.
So what's
the downside?
So this week in preparing for GeekSpeak, I sat down with my articles and my notes, and I did it all on the iPad. So I've got Evernote on one side, and I've got the browser on the other side, and both of these are updated to work with the bit larger size and allow you to have multitasking. But there's so many obvious things that aren't there yet. You can't select text from the browser and drag it over into Evernote. Mm. In fact, OS X and therefore iOS has had a problem with the clipboard, the copying and pasting, for as long as I've ever used it. And that bug is still there, where you'll copy from one app, you go to the other app, and you try to paste, and it's not updated the clipboard sometimes.
Oh, really? Is that why that delay happens, where you have to paste, you try it again?
Yes, and you try it again, and all of a sudden it shows up. They've never synced that up perfectly. There's always a little glitch there that shows up. And
any buyer's remorse?
Not at all.
Okay.
I can't wait to get the pencil.
Can we call it here's stylus on the GeekSpeak? Can we just call it the Apple
call
stylus?
It stylus. Okay. Yeah, because it's not a pencil. It rolls. It's a smooth. It doesn't have that, a six-sided?
Yeah, hexagonal shape.
Hexagonal shape. Yeah, it doesn't have that. It's weighted, so if it rolls, it'll stop.
Maybe.
But the other thing I wanted to... You got me off track.
Sorry about that.
There's other little glitches that I really am surprised by. So with the keyboard, this is the first keyboard on-screen keyboard for iOS that has enough room that some of the keys have... You know, on a regular keyboard, you've got a number and then a symbol above it. Uh-huh. So you've got two characters on one key.
Use the shift to toggle between the two, sure.
Right. So it actually shows that on the digital keyboard. So sometimes I'll try to get the at symbol. Like, we use it in
it's
many times.
It's a shift two, I believe.
Shift two. So if it's the beginning of a word, it gets confusing on whether you hit shift and then that key.
Do you know that you can hold the shift button down like a traditional keyboard? You don't have to tap the shift and then
I do know that, but it doesn't tell you which character you're going to get when you tap it. And I've been getting the wrong one 90% of the time.
Interesting.
And so I've been sitting there for 5 minutes trying to figure
out
which...
I think a glass keyboard with no tactile, I cannot get used to. My kids can, so for them this will be easy, but I have a lot of trouble trying to type on that thing.
Yeah. So it's been no end of confusion for me about that. But, I remember what you sidetracked me from.
Mm.
So, yes, no buyer's remorse. But here's the thing. This is the first iPad I've had. I've been waiting for them to make this device ever since I saw that first iPad that you brought home from the university that one time.
So you still don't have a pencil, though. That's what you really want.
Not yet.
But if anyone has a pencil and they're not using it yet, please send it to Brian. He'll pay for it and everything.
I'll go to the Apple store after the show.
They don't have them in stock.
Maybe. Okay, so this giant device is not ready for all of the apps that are existing out there, and I'm waiting for... Well, I'm not waiting. I'm going to enjoy the pencil, but I can't wait for developers to start updating these apps before it's usable.
And keep in mind, it's not the developer's fault, right? I mean, Apple hasn't had this feature set, and they're finally having this feature set. That's the thing that's exciting to me about the iPad Pro. It's not about what it is right now. It's about this, to me, feels like the future of computing. Because as I've used my iPhone and it's become my primary device, and even a staunch computer, laptop user, or even desktop user, now the computing device I use the most is the phone. And the secondary device, of course, that I use is the laptop. But most of the stuff I do on my laptop, besides my programming skills, can be done on an iPad. If the iPad just a little bit more features, right? So it's just that border boundary, which at some point I'm pretty sure my primary computing device will be my phone still, and then a tablet.
So, yeah, here's the thing. We were at this point where the iPad was so much, there was so much promise when it came out, and then it seems to have leveled off. And I've been hearing lots of people saying now that there's no possible way to get there. It's not that the iPad is ever going to supersede most people's use of a laptop. It seems to have lost its promise. But
For me, though, in my bag, I carry an iPad, a laptop, and a pad of paper. And the reason I carry a pad of paper is so I can sketch and draw and take quick notes. And at some point, the tablets will have that feature set just like paper and better.
So do you think someday it'll replace the need for a laptop for 90% of the people, 99% of the people?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it already probably, it's pretty close to that right now.
But what about, so I'm sitting down with Evernote and Safari, and I'm trying to copy things
that'll
from one to
better.
The other.
Obviously, that'll get better, right?
And I realize I can't... control the styles in Evernote like I can on a computer. I can't switch things around as quickly as I can.
And right now you got a laptop in front of you instead of the iPad.
Exactly. Well, the timer's running on the iPad.
But okay, Ben, are we boring you? I'm sorry, sir.
I'm sorry.
You're not an iPad guy, but you got any input on this?
Nah.
No?
I'm just waiting for the segment to be over.
Oh, no.
You Apple fanboys.
Oh, no.
But here's the thing.
It is a beautiful device, though.
There's an article by a gentleman named Benedict Evans, and I thought this was a really fascinating article, and it goes on about why this really is the future of computing. Yeah. And it's really fascinating to think about how many devices are out there, like Android and iOS and tablet devices. There are 5-to-1 devices like that compared to a regular computer, compared to an Intel computer. There is so much research, so much money, and so much development going into these ARM-based tablet devices that Intel is starting to have a hard time keeping up with their chips and with...
Let's go. ARM does not mean like you have to hold them with your arms, which is really funny because all these ARM devices you do hold with your arms. But ARM devices are a type of processor rather than like a traditional laptop processor. It's a mobile processor. So these ARM devices, Intel's doing what with them? What's the issue?
Well, the issue is that we have now so much money and research going into these mobile computing
platforms,
CPUs, and the whole system on a chip, that Intel is having a hard time keeping up now. And what Benedict Evans makes a case for is why in 10 years we absolutely will be doing most of our work, even in the office, on something like this iPad.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the pain points that exist on a laptop that you get rid of with an iPad. One is backup. People don't actually back up their computers. Hard drives on computers are normally really big, and you have a larger problem there. When you start moving to a tablet-type device, the way that it actually works the best is if you think of it as a disposable, like it can be replaced quickly, and all the documents are actually synced to cloud services. So you're talking about Evernote, and Evernote, of course, syncs with Dropbox. So Dropbox is an account. You could go log in with your Dropbox, your Evernote account on my laptop using your Dropbox account, and all your data would be there. So the device doesn't own the data like a laptop owns data. So that's a big one. And then the other features are installing software, removing software. All of this has been controlled and subjugated. You've been subjugated by your own control by the App Store. The device gets new stuff and removes stuff very, very easily. And those features are really hard for most people to deal with. Us geeks actually have backup solutions, and we like to actually install our own software and remove our software sometimes. So for us, it's probably we're the farthest staunch, you know, remove from using these as our primary. But as they fulfill more and more need and they're still simpler, I got to say that at some point it becomes an obvious choice for me.
Well, yeah, but how do you get the work done that you want to get done?
Like programming?
Yeah. Okay. So take programming. There's a lot of text work in that you're switching between.
No. I'm not going to program on an iPad. It's not happening.
But okay. So you're not going to do it now. But the work that we're going to be doing in 10 years is likely going to be changed by what the device can do, as much as the device will adapt to the way we want to work.
We've done this before. We went through this before because I was a programmer with a desktop machine. It was a Windows desktop machine, and somebody had a very light laptop that we actually got for reviewing on GeekSpeak. And I started using it, and I told people, "Yeah, I use my email and I do search the web on it, but I'm not going to like program on this thing because it wasn't powerful enough, right?" And over time, of course, now my primary machine, I don't even have a desktop machine, is a laptop. So the shifts in what a system can do, of course, change over time. And I agree that most likely at some point, almost all my creativity stuff will be on something like more like a tablet than on a laptop. Though my generation will never lose a keyboard. We'll never let go of the keyboard. And so because we won't let go of the keyboard, the tablet will not be our native device like it will be for our children.
That's probably true.
So with you guys talking about how much you like this new thing that you bought, I thought I should talk about something I like that I bought. And this is a quick one. It's XKCD, and maybe we'll talk about it after the break.
Yeah, that sounds good. You're listening to GeekSpeak here on KOSP. We'll be right back. It's GeekSpeak on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell speaking with Brian Young and Ben Jaffe. What XKCD, the comic book?
Yes, XKCD, the webcomic.
So true.
The only webcomic that I listen to and love. It's just fantastic, especially for geeks like me.
Did you say listen to? Is there an audiobook version?
I'm sorry. I'm in radio land right now. I don't listen to it. In any case, there was a wonderful comic. This is xkcd.com/1133. Yes, this is number 1133. He's made a lot of these things. The guy's name is Randall Monroe. And it is called Upgoer 5. And it's trying to show off all of the different features of the Saturn V rocket using only the top 1,000 words people use.
Nice.
So the most frequently used 1,000 words.
The vocabulary that any English speaker actually has readily available.
Right, yeah. So and
read it
sometimes it actually makes it a little bit more confusing. But it says, us space teams, Upgoer 5, the only flying space car that's taken anyone to another world, explained using only the 1,000 words people use the most often. Because the word 1,000 isn't in that. So there's a little arrow. It says, people box. I'm just reading sections of this. This part that I'm looking at now is the, quote, part that flies around the other world and comes back home with the people in it and falls in the water. Then there's the cold ordering. Air for burning and breathing. This part has had a very big problem once. it's just fantastic. So you just go down and these are feet that go on the ground of the other world, because the word moon is not one of the top 1,000. This is the kind of air that once burned a big sky bag and people died and someone said, oh, the humans used for burning. That was the...
Oh, the humanity. Yeah. That's actually what it was said, yeah.
I was going to make a joke that the top 1,000 words, what is it, like a fifth grade education, but now I'm lowering it to like pre-K.
Yeah, 1,000 is actually not a lot of words.
Yeah, this is the part of air you need to breathe, but not the other stuff used for burning. Fire comes out here.
It's amazing. It's great. You know, so, we've done quite a few XKCD's reads on air. Of course, for radio, comics are not the best form of... but you did a great job. This is a really good comic on air.
Thank you.
I'm impressed.
Thank you
so much.
So the reason that I bring this up is there's a book coming out called Thing Explainer, Complicated Stuff in Simple Words, by the same guy.
Oh, perfect.
Explaining not just the Saturn V rocket, but oh so many other things.
So you can actually ask him questions like how fast, you know, if you threw a baseball at the speed of light, what would happen? And he actually calculates it out. It's just fantastic.
And figures out
his work. And yeah, his comic book.
So this is amazing.
His whole collection of work is on xkcd.com. You can read for hours and hours if you like geeky
amazing
stuff.
He also has a whole series called What If, which is what you were referring to.
Yes.
It's just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful stuff.
So is that book a compilation or is it a new
work? No, it's a new work. And I pre-ordered it. Speaking of things that we've bought and we're talking about on the air.
For my birthday or from...
No, for me. For my birthday.
Oh. So can I draw on it with my pencil?
I guess if you buy a scanner.
Hey, Ben, since you're talking about the orbiter that went around the other other world. Can you talk about more about that other world?
Oh my gosh, this is a wonderful story talking about why the moon's two sides look so different. So first, let's just talk about the moon.
When you picture the moon, it can be light or dark or somewhere in between, but it actually always looks the same. I mean, besides light and dark.
Why is that?
Because it's in a tidal lock.
Because
of our ocean system, the moon at one point stopped rotating or keeps one rotation the same face always faces us. That's called tidal lock.
Another way to say it is every time it goes around us, it rotates a full 360 degrees. So imagine like if you're standing and then imagine I'm standing in a room and Lyle, you're walking around me, but you're always facing me.
Yeah. The best way to explain this is if you take a 2-year-old and you grab their arms and you say, is it okay if I swing you? And they say, yeah. And you start swinging them, you'll notice that their face always faces you because you're holding on to them.
It'd be really awkward if they didn't. Yeah.
But anyway, that's what the tidal lock is, the effect of stopping the rotation of the moons. The moon used to at some point actually orbit. Also spin, and it now locks to us. And therefore, we always see one side. So the dark side of the moon just means intellectually dark from us. Like, we don't know what it looks like without leaving our system.
You know, we actually...
It's not always dark, of course, because it changes from light to dark, just like our moon changes from light to dark.
Right. Yeah. So one thing to just point out, this isn't exactly true. It is tidally locked, but we can see a little bit more than half of it because of a thing called lunar libration, which is just where, as you're walking around me, always facing towards me, you kind of rotate a little bit from side to side from my perspective.
Well,
so
the best
maybe
way to
I can
this,
see a little bit yeah. of your right side, a little bit of your left side, but I certainly can't see your backside, right?
So when the moon is at the horizon, either setting or rising, you are one edge of the Earth compared to it, and then the other time when it on the other horizon, you're on the other edge of the Earth, and the duration, the size of the Earth, if you will, allows you to see partly more than both sides.
Well, there's more going on to it than that, but that's a piece of it, I think.
No, that's it.
Are you sure?
Yeah,
lunar libration.
It has to do with two angles, right? It's like a parallax where you have two eyes. If you cover one eye and then you switch back and forth covering your eye, you'll see that your scene shifts. You see different sides.
Nope, just Googled it. So the
is it also rotating?
The moon also does a little bit of kind of a wobbling back and forth, a rotational wobble back and forth
between,
relative to the Earth.
Of the lock, you mean? The tidal lock actually
yeah.
shifts a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that because of our tides? Because of our mass, the Earth shifts?
No, I think it might be just residual.
Well, what I was saying also is true. You're going to see partially different sides.
Right.
But let's move on,
That's
we?
What I was saying, is that we're both right. Why can't we all just get along?
I like being right. That's fun.
Let's move on. 55 years ago, the Soviet spacecraft Luna 3 went around to the far side of the moon, and that's the first time that we were able to see 100% of the moon. We were able to see the closer side and the far side. And,
well, a Russian satellite was able to see.
They
took photos.
We noticed something weird, right? Mm-hmm. And it's that the far side of the moon is very cratered. And
the front side is pretty cratered, too. More so than the front side?
Very cratered.
Whoa!
It's much more cratered. So,
do you have a picture?
I do.
Do you have a picture you can share with everybody?
Let me just describe it on the radio. No, okay. So,
is it like a teenager with acne, or is it like?
Oh, that just me.
Oh, I don't want to go there.
So there's a lot more craters on the far side of the moon, or the other thing is the dark side is what we call it, but
right.
The far side of the moon has a lot more craters than the close side.
Right. So, in any case, if you look at the two, you'll see that one is more cratered, one is less cratered. And you start to think, why? Like, why is that? And one thing we were talking about before the show, actually, Lyle, is you said, well, the Earth is there to kind of, you know, vacuum up any of the asteroids that might be about to hit the moon, you know, just kind of like block them like a soccer player or something like that.
Yeah, that was my guess, was that there's this giant planet and therefore stuff that comes from that side maybe doesn't hit as much. And the other thing, of course, is that if stuff orbits us, it's more likely to hit from, well, that would be the side. So what is it?
Right. So actually so that does account for some of it. Like basically the Earth does say, yeah, I'll grab that asteroid and that asteroid, and then those asteroids won't hit the moon.
Uh-huh.
Whereas on the other side, there's nothing stopping the asteroids from hitting
the moon. Let me think for a second. There's something else?
There is, but
okay.
I don't think you're going to get it. But first I'll say that your hypothesis is a factor, but it's less than 1% of a difference is what it should result in. And the difference in crateredness between the far side and the close side of the moon is much bigger than that.
Are you saying it only accounts for 1% of the number of craters?
If it was just that the Earth was catching asteroids on their way, then the difference would be less than, would be about 1% difference between how cratered one side versus the other side.
The other thing about that side.
So there's another.
The other thing about that side is it gets closer and more exposed to the sun, but that's only
not
partially.
Really.
Well, it gets closer, obviously.
Well,
but
teeny, teeny bit. Okay, so.
No, the orbit of the moon, that's how much closer it gets. But also, it gets.
Which is.
And then the shadow of the Earth is not going to affect it.
So I'm going to tell you because the process of trying to figure it out in your own head
is
not as good radio. The way the moon formed, it takes us all the way back to the way the moon formed.
Oh, okay.
And we actually recently got enough information with this particular study that came out just this June, actually. About the way the Earth and the moon formed. And so basically the Earth was just hanging out, minding its own business. We didn't have a moon. And then some huge body about the size of Mars, what Mars is today, crashed into the Earth and blasted a bunch of material out. And eventually the Mars body and the Earth body became all Earth. But there was a bunch of little rocks and things that were kind of floating around on the outside. And actually, there's a wonderful, wonderful simulation up on YouTube that's just incredibly mesmerizing to watch.
About the coalescing of the moon?
What kind of...
Within about a year of that. All those little pebbles and rocks and everything coalesce into this other body, which is the moon.
Sure.
It doesn't have any crazy rotation, and so it's already tidally locked.
Oh, cool.
The Earth is still very hot at this point.
We melted the moon?
We melted one side of the moon, or we kept one side of the moon melted, whereas the other side was able to cool off a lot faster. So imagine, just for a moment.
That's a long time of melted.
Right. So imagine just for a moment, you've got this moon that's going around. This is when the Earth is really, really, really hot. I've got a number here somewhere that I'll find in a second.
Which will be too big for us to understand. So really, really hot is fine.
2,700 Kelvin is about how...
It's glowing, baby.
It's glowing. We're keeping one side of the moon, the side that's always facing us, liquid, like lava, right? So some asteroids hit it. What's going to happen? What happens when you drop a rock into the ocean? It doesn't leave a crater. It just gets absorbed. Oh, you're having fun with that.
That's good.
The other side of the moon is solid, because it's not being kept warm by the heat of the Earth.
Sure.
Fantastic. Isn't that crazy?
Fantastic. Thank you. I think I would have gotten there eventually.
Eventually. But we might have been out of time.
Yeah, definitely. Really cool. So I'm assuming, so this study happened relatively recently. I didn't know that we were tidally locked right away. I did know that our planet and moon system got formed by a collision. I'd heard that before.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't know that the particulate matter didn't ever have a rotation. That's really interesting.
Right, right.
It's also interesting how smooth and round it is comparatively, like that would actually happen over time. I guess that's from being pummeled and reshaped to some degree, or just the gravitational force of all those pebbles.
Yeah.
Man.
It's crazy
science
stuff.
Is cool, man.
And you know, like the, just for reference, the rock that hit us that wiped out the dinosaurs was maybe 5 to 10 kilometers across.
And a lot longer. I mean, a lot farther past that, like, much closer to our time frame than when...
More recent.
Yes, thank you.
That's yeah. There's a word.
There's a thing in the jug.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, this other body, the size of Mars, I mean, that's huge.
All right. Thanks for that wonderful story about the moon. I appreciate it. So, Brian, the one thing when Ben told me he was going to start working at Facebook is he said, are you guys going to tease me on air? And I'm not going to, because I think Facebook's pretty fantastic. But I can't talk to Ben about that. So you want to talk about Facebook real quick?
So we've had many a time where we have either criticized Facebook or brought up things that we didn't appreciate about how pervasive it is in either our life or friends of ours' lives.
And the change it's brought about. I mean, there's a whole bunch of side effects about that kind of system in place. But
yeah.
Go on.
And I'm sure we'll still bring up things that we do not appreciate about Facebook even when Ben starts there. But there is something that I've been watching in my own life that I wanted to bring up. And that is... So on the internet, one of the big problems is anonymity and trolling.
Yeah.
And they don't have to go hand in hand, but they often do. The trolling where people just want to rail about some feeling that they have and just dump on people online.
And just be nasty. Bad citizenship.
It brings out the worst in people. Well, I've seen something happen that brings out the best in people, and I wanted to bring it up, and it might be useful for other communities. In my town, not too far away from yours, it's Boulder Creek, California, we have a private Facebook group that was started by one person who happened to live in our town. And he was particularly disgusted by all the trolling that he'd seen going on different various...
Community forums.
Everything from Google groups, Yahoo groups. There's a plethora of them out there. So what he decided to do was he was not going to make some democratic group where anybody can join. He decided he would make a Facebook group with one rule. The rule is that you're going to be kind to people if you join. So he takes invitations and he lets people in. And as soon as they run afoul of the kindness rule,
they get booted off. I bet that's a wonderfully successful forum.
It is. And it is. The thing that works so well about it is it's local and limits the number of people to that locality or people who are connected to Boulder Creek, even though they're not physically there. And the kind of things I've seen happen on there have been fantastic. People have been using it for not only connecting with the community, but we knew the El Nino season could be strong this year. And so they put out a word and made a Google Doc where people could submit whether they could be a first responder, whether they could help their neighbor if there was a heavy storm. Mm-hmm. People are, you know, doing the normal things of putting lost cats and lost dogs on there. But
we have one of these in Ben Lomond as well. Yeah. And after I was added to it, I became a moderator as well, so I can add people. It's a little more open than what you're suggesting. I don't think there's like, strict rules. But I have to say, but being a moderator on different forums over my career as a geek, I found that the crucial thing to understand is that the community experience on the forum is more important than any individual's freedom of speech. And that's a really hard thing to think of when you have a dogma set so strong that freedom of speech is paramount. Because the truth is, freedom of speech is sometimes horribly painful and nasty, and you have to walk away from it, right? We support people that want to speak even when we don't support what they say. But in a forum where you want to have communication and open, shared experience, you actually want to limit that freedom so that it is a safe place for people to be. And so if you're managing a forum, do what Brian's Boulder Creek Forum is doing. Limit what people can say so that people feel safe.
Yeah, make it a simple rule and people can follow it. And it has been fantastic. I've been really impressed.
Ben's got a really interesting story about bridges. But first, let me mention that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use it any way you like. Just let them know the geeks say hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org or email us geeks@geekspeak.org if you'd like to ask us questions and such and respond to the show. And of course, we're on Twitter and Facebook at KOSP Geeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Ben, what you got?
Suspension Bridges of Disbelief. This is a blog post by a bridge engineer showing the destruction of bridges in different movies and how these ways that bridges are collapsing doesn't make any sense. It should clearly be this way or that way.
A suspension bridge breaking right in the middle, and it does seem wrong.
Yeah, it's like if you have a clothesline and you cut the clothesline in the middle, what should happen?
Right.
Well, it collapses and all the clothes fall off. It's not going to just like become stronger like in The Dark Knight Rises here. And there's a screenshot. You can go to our website
awesome.
And click on the link.
We'll have it at geekspeak.org. Thanks, Ben. This is Ben Jaffe and Brian Young. I'm Lyle Troxell. The show is also supported by Chandler, our intern. Thank you so much, Chandler. And Greg Merkley, our Canadian correspondent. This is the episode for the 28th of November of Geekspeak. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week and online.